So I'm giving this lead off about Trotsky's writings of the 1930s. And this is a body of work and a period which are absolutely a goldmine of lessons for the revolutionary movement, for the international working class. And it's a shame because the writings of this period are in the main unavailable to revolutionary activists. So this is because of the scandalous actions of Pathfinder Books, the publishing house of the American Socialist Workers' Party, who they own the rights to the translations of these articles. And they have forced the Marxist Internet Archive and other sources to remove these articles from their websites. And because they want to protect their profits, that there's a 14-volume writings of Leon Trotsky, 1929 to 1940. And they can make a lot of money selling these things to university libraries and such places. And they're not cheap. They're $25 to $35 per book. So this is a huge barrier to most people to actually reading these ideas, and they're not available online. It's also, you know, full of lessons of us, for us, because, you know, if you look at the period, this was the aftermath of the 1929 crash, the beginning of the Great Depression. You saw the rise of centrism as a mass force, centrism being a tendency that exists between left reformism and fully fledged Marxism. You had the complete degeneration of Stalinism, and you had the beginning, the formation of the Fourth International, and the analysis that Trotsky and his supporters went through to actually come to the conclusion of a new international. Well, unlike Trotsky's biographer, Isaac Deutscher, in The Prophet Outcast, we view this as and Trotsky viewed this as the most important period of his life. Deutscher saw this 1930s as somewhat of a wasted decade. That, you know, the highlight of Trotsky's political career was the revolution and the civil war and the initial fight against Stalinism. But in the 30s, he was out in the wilderness and defeated. Whereas Trotsky actually viewed this as the most important period of his life. Because every other time in his political activity, there was somebody else present that could also give the lead. From, you know, the late 19th century, there was Plekhanov. Through the early 20th century, leading up to the revolution, there was Lenin. But after the death of Lenin, the red thread was picked up by Trotsky. And only he could pass on the traditions and the lessons of Bolshevism that were being slandered and a heap full of excrement was being poured on top by both the imperialists in the West and the Stalinists in the East. The tradition of Bolshevism was being lost, and it was Trotsky's job to maintain that for the future. And that is what the International Marxist Tendency and Fight Back exists for, to learn from these lessons and deepen them still to maintain that tradition. I'm not going to go through the entire period. I'm going to go from 1930 to 1938 in this lead-off, because that expresses a good chunk of time. It'd be very difficult for me to actually complete this lead-off in the necessary time. But 1930, Trotsky finds himself expelled from the Soviet Union, and he's in exile in Turkey. And the 1930, the Trotskyists, well, they didn't like to be called Trotskyists. They called themselves the Bolshevik Leninists. They considered themselves an expelled faction of the Communist International. They founded the International Left Opposition in 1930. And the aim was, through comradely criticism, to gain readmittance to the Communist International, that the belief was that the Communist International could be reformed, that while they had a disgusting Thermidorian bureaucracy, had seized hold of the Russian Communist Party and the Communist International, that the Communist International still organized millions upon millions of revolutionary workers, and it was the job of the International Left Opposition to reach these workers. And this coincided the period immediately after the 1929 crash, when millions of workers, just as we are seeing today, were questioning capitalism. They see this capitalism as a situation of crisis, and that there was an alternative in the Soviet Union. And Trotsky appealed for the Communist International to adopt the right slogans and the right tactics to reach these millions of workers who are looking for a change. But unfortunately, the Stalinists had adopted the third period philosophy, that capitalism had entered its third period, which was typified by unending crisis. There was just an ending slump, and there would no longer be any more booms. That in this period, that all forces that weren't fighting for revolution were essentially fascist, and it came up with the theory of social fascism, that the socialists, the social democrats, the reformist parties were effectively the same as the fascists, and they adopted crazy ultra-left abstentionism, which put a brick wall between the communist workers and the mass of the wider working class, be they reformist or be they not aligned to any political party. They were just coming into political activity. And this stopped the Communist International from making sweeping gains in this movement. And Trotsky waged a vociferous criticism against the Stalinists. As well, this ultra-left turn on the international stage was also reflected inside Russia, where for the previous period, in their fight with the left opposition, the Stalinists had moved to the right, and Bukharin came forward and with the phrase, enrich yourselves. They lent on the kulak, the rich peasant, and they did that to defeat the left opposition. But once the left opposition were expelled from the Communist Party in 1927 and Trotsky was kicked out of the Soviet Union, what ended up happening is the logic of leaning on the kulak started to express itself, and capitalist economic relations started to really express themselves in the countryside. The kulaks came forward wanting, as well as economic benefits, they wanted a political say. And this endangered the bureaucracy whose power existed on the back of the planned economy. And so the Stalinists, from ridiculing the left opposition's call for a five-year plan, they then did a somersault over Trotsky's head and called for not just a five-year plan, but a five-year plan in 4 years. That bureaucratically, top-down demand, ridiculous growth rates, 25, 30%. And the whole notion of quality was just thrown out of the window just for mass production. And this had an even more tragic effect in the countryside, where the forced, rather than voluntary collectivization, forced collectivization was on the order of the day. Forced collectivization, which it started off, the position of the International Left Opposition was that of a voluntary collectivization, where peasants, seeing the productivity, seeing the increased working conditions, the improved working conditions in the collective farms, would then decide to bring their land together and move on that basis. That was the position of the left opposition. And but Stalin started the forced collectivization, where they went from something like 15% collective farms to upwards of 50% collective farms in a bureaucratic fashion, which the peasants completely revolted against. This they refused this forced collectivization, and it led to mass starvation, a civil war in the countryside, in effect, and it was a disaster. It led to mass starvations, and Trotsky, analyzed this and said, this was an absolute disaster. And this is typical of Stalinism, going from opportunism to ultra-leftism and back again. But fantastic. I'm going to quote at length from a number of different articles from the period of the 30s, just to show comrades and as a sort of a flavour of the writings of the period. And I'd say, without doubt, that any revolutionary activist who wishes to lead at some point has to sit down and read the writings of this period. You have to absorb the lessons. And one of the most important sort of theme of the period is the necessity for Marxist perspectives. The necessity for Marxist perspectives. And the best article on this is something Trotsky wrote in 1930, the third period of the Comintern's eras, where he spoke about how to actually develop perspective. I think the writings of this period, in many ways, you could characterize them as the theory of agitation, the theory of tactics. So you know how to do day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month politics and analyze the real situation. And I'll quote from the third period of Comintern's eras. So part four, the art of orientation. The art of revolutionary leadership is primarily the art of correct political orientation. Under all conditions, communism prepares the political vanguard and through it the working class as a whole for the revolutionary seizure of power. But it does it differently in different fields of the labour movement and in different periods. One of the most important elements in orientation is the determination of the temper of the masses, their activity and readiness for struggle. The mood of the masses, however, is not predetermined. It changes under the influence of certain laws of mass psychology that are set into motion by objective social conditions. The political state of the class is subject, within certain limits, to a quantitative determination. Press circulation, attendance at meetings, elections, demonstrations, strikes, etc. In order to understand the dynamics of the process, it is necessary to determine in what direction and why the mood of the working class is changing. Combining subjective and objective data, it is possible to establish a tentative perspective of the movement, that is, a scientifically based prediction, without which a serious revolutionary struggle is in general inconceivable. But a prediction in politics does not have the character of a perfect blueprint. It is a working hypothesis. While leading the struggle in one direction or another, it is necessary to attentively follow the changes in the objective and subjective elements of the movement in order to opportunely introduce corresponding corrections in tactics. Even though the actual development of the struggle never fully corresponds to the prognosis, that does not absolve us from making political predictions. One must not, however, get intoxicated with finished schemata, but continually refer to the course of the historic process and adjust to its indications. So it's incredibly profound. And Trotsky, in this article, ridiculed the ideas of the Stalinists, where they said that boom equals class peace and slump equals class war, that Trotsky analysed that, in fact, it is the change from one to another that can radicalise the masses. If you look at present-day situation, we are facing a new 1929, a new Great Depression. But that does not mean that the workers will immediately move into mass movements. They have moved in mass movements in some countries, Greece, France, Ireland. But we've seen in Canada that the factories occupation movement that was seemed to be growing about a year ago seemed to have been cut across by the economic slump, because people are incredibly afraid for their jobs, for their conditions, and combine that with the betrayal of the union leaders, there's incredible confusion. So there's not a linear relationship between the economic base and the class struggle. There's a dialectical relationship. There's a complex relationship. But what we can say is that the psychological effects are massive in the ranks of the working class, who are looking for answers. And any moment, this may break out in mass struggle in Canada, the United States. But we are preparing huge explosions. So this is a fantastic work. I don't think it's available online, but I would encourage people to find a copy of it in the library. And in the other great work that Trotsky wrote in 1930 was the five-year plan and world unemployment, that he appealed to the Communist International to adopt a strategy that would speak to the mass of the multi-million mass of the working class in a transitional manner, that rather than socialism in one country, rather than autarky, rather than pulling in, that the Soviet Union, which was also facing its own economic crisis, unfortunately this was a crisis created by the bureaucracy, created by the overheated tempo of growth and the forced collectivization, that instead of this, that the mass of the working class was facing the scourge of unemployment, you know, 20, 25, 30% in many of the, 50% in some of the capitalist countries. And Trotsky said, well, what the Communist International should demand is to save jobs, create jobs by economic cooperation between the USSR and the advanced capitalist nations. That the workers could be employed in Britain and France and Germany and the United States, producing machinery that could then be exported to the Soviet Union, and in return could get raw materials, foodstuffs, and such like, creating jobs and boosting the economy on both sides. So Trotsky was ridiculed by the Stalinists, said, oh, you're just doing what you can to support, to bolster imperialism by this. But Trotsky understood this is what was necessary to gain the ear of the masses, and also understood that politically there was no way that the imperialists would agree to this. There'd been an economic blockade against the Soviet Union for ever since the revolution, and this would pose the fact that the crass imperialism of the imperialist powers, that they would not be prepared to employ workers, you know, even if, you know, hundreds of thousands of workers to aid the Soviet Union, they'd rather have them unemployed rather than aid the young workers' state. So Trotsky put that forward. So moving on in the period, Trotsky, as we in the recent period have focused our attention on Latin America as the center of the world revolution, and especially Venezuela. In the period of the 1930s, Trotsky analyzed and focused on a series of countries which each represented the focal point of the world revolution, and he demanded that the forces of the international left opposition discuss each of these countries and put on the agenda of each of their meetings the events. And in 1931, 32, 33, Trotsky aimed his analysis at Germany. Germany was the country which was the center of the world revolution. I don't have time to go into a detailed analysis of the rise of fascism in Germany. And but as I'm sure comrades have studied the question in the past, but here you saw that the Stalinist position of social fascism gave it was a gift to Hitler. That in fact sometimes the communists, the Stalinists, would unite with the fascists to break up socialist meetings. That the theory of social fascism actually aided more than anything else the victory of fascism. In the final Reichstag elections, the combined votes of the socialists and the communists was over and above, I think it was something from memory, I think the combined votes of the socialists and communists were something like 11 million, whereas the votes of the fascists and the right-wing parties was 9 million. So with a united front tactic, the fascists could have been defeated, but the Stalinists had a completely ultra-left position. And this led to, when Hitler came to power in 1933, he could brag about how he came to power without breaking a window pane. And the tragedy of it was that it was true. The Stalinists had a completely utopian position. That they said that, Hitler's now our turn next. So they could not understand what a historical defeat for the working class this was. And Hitler proceeded to destroy piecemeal the workers' movement in Germany. What was the strongest movement in the whole of Europe? And this led Trotsky to a re-evaluation of the position of the international left opposition as a expelled minority of the Communist International. That what happened after the collapse of the German working class, that there was not a single critical word in the entire Communist International, that nothing happened. And Trotsky said, look, this is it. We can no longer sort of view ourselves as an expelled faction of the Communist International. This international, there is a river of blood between genuine Marxism and the Stalinists. And we need to start calling for the formation of the Fourth International. And this starts, and as all times, when the revolutionary movement takes a turn, there's always internal opposition. Now, any sort of serious movement, any serious change in tactics and strategy, always creates polemics. And Trotsky, a large portion of the works of this period are also very polemical in nature, dealing with ultra-leftism, dealing with opportunism, dealing with the ultra-left elements that become comfortable in their isolation and don't want change, or opportunist elements that adapt to the period they're in. So, and I'll deal with this more in detail later. Just as, at the same period of time, on January 1933, that the Trotsky faces another personal setback, a personal crisis. Zinaida Volkova, his daughter, commits suicide in Germany. And this is a great blow to the family. And she was driven to suicide by the Stalinists. She was ill and allowed to leave the Soviet Union with her son, Esteban Volkov. Some comrades would have met him a couple of weeks ago in Mexico. But she came ill and she went to Germany to get treatment. But while she was there, the Stalinists removed her citizenship, removed her passport, so she could not return to the Soviet Union, where her husband and her other child was. And unfortunately, the isolation led to this poor woman committing suicide. And Trotsky went through a whole series of personal attacks. The privations that Trotsky's family had to go through were just amazing, and yet they continued the fight. Trotsky was not satisfied being in Turkey, but he needed to be in the center of Europe for the political fight, and was successful. After living in Turkey for 4 years at Prinkipol, he managed to get a visa to travel to France. And so in 1933, he travels to France. At the same time, there is a meeting of socialists in France, were largely centrist currents, and the Trotskyists succeed in Trotsky writes the Declaration of Four for the Fourth International. So this is the Trotskyists who've adopt the name the International Communist League in preparation for the formation of the Fourth International, and two Dutch centrist currents and one German centrist current. And the fact, analysing that Stalinism is dead to the international labour movement, the Third International is dead, we need a Fourth International. Trotsky also analysed the class nature of the Soviet state, where he, throughout this period, he developed the analysis that the Soviet Union was a deformed workers' state, deformed by Stalinism, but it was not state capitalism. It was not bureaucratic collectivism or any other word. It was a deformed workers' state, and numerous times the Trotskyists put as a condition of membership the military defense, the defense of the Soviet Union, the unconditional defense of the Soviet Union against imperialist aggression. So, moving on. From another sort of significant work of this period, Trotsky wrote War and the Fourth International. That, analyzing and developing Lenin's position on revolutionary defeatism. That it was not, like, Lenin's position of revolutionary defeatism was a very sort of hard position in order to educate the revolutionaries. But Trotsky developed that into the idea of the military revolutionary policy, how it was necessary to have a revolutionary war against fascism, but that the imperialist nations, the imperialist bourgeois, were incapable of conducting such a war. And so the only way to end war was by the eradication of capitalism for a workers' government, which would then conduct a revolutionary war against fascism and imperialism. But after the defeat of Germany, after the defeat of the working class of Germany due to the aiding and abetted by the Stalinists, the centre of political gravity moved to France. France was in a period of absolute turmoil, that the fascists actually attempted to overthrow the government, and that led to the fall of the government and a more right-wing government, a more right-wing cabinet coming to power, a general strike by the workers. And the victory of fascism in Germany had completely, appalled the public opinion of the working class internationally. You know, people were asking, how could this happen? How could this happen? And the Stalinists were starting to recoil from their ultra-left position of the previous period, of third period, that even though they had made no analysis of their ultra-left position. What they were, and what Trotsky was always calling for in the third period is for a united front between the communist and the socialist workers. Well, it appeared in France especially that the Stalinists were starting to adopt Trotsky's advice. They moved closer to the Socialist Party, which was also moving further to the left. They had a conference where the right wing split away, and it appeared that the Stalinists and the Socialists would fuse. There was talk of organic unity. But then the Stalinists proceeded a step further. They didn't just go from ultra-left abstentionism to the United Front. They went through the United Front to the Popular Front and demanded a liberal, democratic worker unity against the fascists, which entirely disarms the workers against the fascist threat. Because it is actually liberalism, that capitalism, that creates the conditions for the rise of fascism. The only genuine way to fight against fascism is to counterpose it with socialism. It's the only thing that can provide an answer to the economic crisis. But the Stalinists went over from being ultra-left to being opportunist, to the Popular Front. As well as the French Socialist Party moving to the left, the same thing happens to the Spanish Socialist Party. In 1934, it leads a general strike, and the youth call for the Trotskyists to enter them and give them the ideas, give them the leadership. Unfortunately, Andrés Nin, the leader of the Spanish Trotskyist, I use the term very loosely. Lin was in sort of opposition to Trotsky's positions right from the start, but they refused to enter the Socialist Party Youth, which just demanded that the youth join the very small forces of the left opposition in Spain. But yeah, Trotsky said, "Well, this is ridiculous. That they're an organization 10 or 100 times your size. They're not going to just join you. You have to go there, join them, give them the leadership." Nin refused. And then the Stalinists took up the mantle. And actually, this is how the Stalinists gained their mass base, on the basis of the socialist youth, in the future, wreck the revolution. Another major event happened in 1934. Kirov, the head of the Moscow Communist Party, He was assassinated, and this was used as a pretext for the beginnings of the purge trials, where the main defendant was always Trotsky. I'll talk about that later. The French section of the International Communist League began what is known as the French Term. This is the beginning of the discussion around entrism, that the right had been expelled from the French Communist Party, French Socialist Party, sorry. And the communists, the Trotskyists, viewed this as an opportunity to go in, to present the need for a Fourth International, to present the need for genuine Marxist politics, and then come out. They were incredibly successful. And they were in there for about a year until they're expelled in 1935, just as the Socialist Party was coming close to the Communist Party in France. And this is when, but it was the same thing. The Trotsky advised the British Trotskyists to enter the Independent Labour Party. And this was unfortunately resisted by some elements in the British Marxists, and they lost opportunities. That it was said, Trotsky said to him, "Look, okay, this is an organization of 100,000. Let's just say that the overwhelming majority of them are petty bourgeois and careerists and useless from a revolutionary perspective. But in Britain, all we have is a few dozen. Say only 1% are workers who are open to a genuine Marxist call. Well, 1% of 100,000 is still 1,000, which is more than enough for our needs at the time. But unfortunately, it was not done in a systematic fashion, and opportunities were lost. There's a lot of opportunities lost. Trotsky was just trying to patiently explain and educate his followers internationally. So the election of a right-wing government in France meant that Trotsky was hounded, that it became a scandal, and Trotsky was chased by both fascists and Stalinists. And he had to essentially go from hostel to hostel around the countryside until he found himself. And they wanted to expel him. They moved a resolution to expel him from France, but no other country would actually allow him to be a refugee. Until in 1935, Trotsky manages to get a visa for Norway, and he travels to Norway. So, in July and August of 1935, we see the solidification of the People's Front line with the 7th and final Communist International Congress. Trotsky is again showing his foresight in his analysis of the 7th Communist International Congress, and analyzes it as that this will be seen in history as the liquidationist Congress. And it's true, it was the final Congress until Stalin, during the Second World War, just dissolved the Communist International without a debate, without any resolutions, without a Congress, anything like that. But, so this is sort of what is going on in the broader sense. Inside the International Communist League, the Trotskyist movement, I alluded to it earlier, that there was when you split, and we've seen this in our own international, that the Trotsky was expelled from the Communist International and then aimed to build the Fourth International in order to save the ideas of Marxism, to save the vanguard. But when you're involved in any serious split like this, not only do you take with you the best elements, the most courageous and fighting elements, the elements which are closest connected to genuine Marxism, unfortunately, you also take with you a whole series of accidental elements. Those opportunists or ultra-lefts. And Trotsky wages an endless war, and it's almost amusing. It is tragically comic to read the writings of this time of yet again somebody somewhere being a complete idiot and making the worst possible mistakes imaginable, and some mistakes that aren't even imaginable. Actually, there's a sort of amusing sort of one paragraph letter that Trotsky wrote on December the 27th, 1935, titled "Request for a Month's Leave of Absence." This is after he'd been pestered by all sides of the factional dispute in the French section and many other sections, which is detailed in a very good book called Crisis of the French Section, which is anybody who wishes to learn about proper Bolshevik methods of organizing should read that. Oh, actually, anybody who wishes to learn about improper methods of Bolshevik organizing should also read that. But we'll see that there's actually very little new, because what's deemed as new ideas get resurrected again and again and again. But this is what Trotsky had to say in December 27th, 1935. "Request for a month's leave of absence. It is absolutely necessary that I should get at least 4 weeks' leave and should not be approached with any letters from the sections. Otherwise, it will be impossible for me to recover my capacity for work. These disgusting trivia not only rob me of my ability to cope with more serious affairs, but give me insomnia, fever, etc. I request you be quite ruthless about this, that I may perhaps be at your disposal again, say, by February 1st. So you can see the exasperation in this poor man's writing, what he had to go through. Later on, he writes, where is this? I'll come back to that later. On the pernicious role of sectarianism within the movement. But moving on. From focusing on Germany, then on France, now the international focus proceeded to Spain. The People's Front gained a victory in February 1936 in the elections. And so that was a unity of the PUM, the so-called Trotskyists. They weren't Trotskyists at all. They'd broken with Trotsky precisely by entering the People's Front government. The communists, the socialists, the liberals, and the anarchists. And in response, the Franco-fascist uprising began in July 1936. The Spanish Revolution initiated a wave of optimism amongst the Russian working class. The working class that had been in many ways in depression since the defeat of the left opposition, the victory in the Civil War, but this Civil War had destroyed the revolutionary workers that put through the 1917 revolution. But this reinvigorated the working class, and the Stalinists had to crack down against this tendency, which would inevitably call for workers' democracy. And they did this through the purge trials. From the Kirov assassination, a series of purge trials, starting off with the first one, which indicted Zinoviev and Kamenev and Trotsky and Sedov, Trotsky's son. And the worst slander against the Trotskyists, and no material evidence presented at all. It was all based on the forced confessions of the convicted. Zinoviev and Kamenev and the other accused were sent to the GPU, the forerunner of the KGB, the GPU torture chambers, where they were forced to capitulate. And in fact, Zinoviev and Kamenev had been repeatedly capitulating since 1927. And so they were already broken, corrupt men, and were prepared to heap shame upon themselves and shame upon Trotsky. And Trotsky attempted to, and began a serious campaign against the frame-up trials, against the Stalinist frame-ups. And in response to this, he's in Norway under the so-called protection of the socialist government of Norway. But Soviet Union, the Stalinists start putting diplomatic pressure upon Norway, which has had significant trade relationships with the Soviet Union, that this was so-called endangering Norway's foreign affairs, position on the international affairs, and they actually locked up Trotsky to stop him with his basic democratic right to defend himself in open court or the court of public opinion. And in December of 1935, Trotsky is forced onto a tanker, not knowing where he's going. And this is the last emigration of his life They forced him on a tanker for Mexico, where he actually, for the first time, is able to freely defend himself. When Trotsky arrives in Mexico, he's taken in by the revolutionary artists Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. Zinoviev and Kamenev are tricked by Stalin. I think they even went so far as to demand the death sentence for themselves, with the assurance from the GPU that, oh, that's okay. You know, you'll get a chance. You'll be sentenced to death, but you'll get a chance to appeal, and then we'll turn it into life imprisonment. And so they're tricked and then executed without any appeal. I think this actually happens while Trotsky hears the news of this while he is on the boat to Mexico. Second witch hunt trial begins, and the leadership of the Red Army is also purged in this period. Finding himself in Mexico, Trotsky has... This is the government which... You had a nationalist, revolutionary, bourgeois nationalist government in Mexico, which actually gave Trotsky a certain freedom, under condition that he does not comment on Mexican political affairs, and he did not, and he stayed out of Mexican politics. But it allowed him the freedom to actually properly wage the fight against the witch hunt trials. And Trotsky helped... They set up the Dewey Commission, where Trotsky said, I stake my life. If this commission finds me guilty, I will give myself up to the Soviet authorities for what would have been inevitable execution in the Soviet Union, and begins a series of hearings where, you know, Trotsky, with the help of his son, Leon Sedov, show step by step, allegation by allegation, that the allegations of the Stalinists could not be true. For example, one so-called Trotskyist agent, who now confessed and then was one of the accused, said that he flew to Norway to meet with Trotsky and get information on saboteur activities assassination activities. But Trotsky proves that there were no flights into the airport on the days that this so-called spy was supposed to meet him. Supposed to be a meeting with Sedov and another so-called Trotskyist agent at a hotel that had been demolished and did not exist. And they go through it, you know, ridiculing the position of the Stalinists. And this has is very effective in turning around public opinion. Because people say, well, how could anybody confess to crimes like this if they weren't true? The sheer horrendousness of it all. But people yet, unfortunately, well, in many ways fortunately, did not understand the role of torture, did not understand, and we've seen this in books like 1984, if you read 1984, or if the fantastic book, The Great Game, by the Leopold Trepper, the head of the Red Orchestra, the Soviet spy agency in Nazi Germany. You see the degrees of torture and what they can make people say and what they make people do. But Trotsky was quite successful. You know, the Trotskyists were quite successful in turning this round. During this period, May 1937, was the Barcelona uprising, which was defeated. And this signals the beginning of the end of the Spanish Revolution. Due to the betrayal of the Stalinists, the betrayal of the anarchists, ditching aside anarchist ideas and entering the bourgeois government, but also the Pumists, the supporters of Nin, and also entered this bourgeois government, and meant that in all essence in Spain there was a dictatorship on either side of the civil war. So, and this is an incredible defeat for the revolutionary movement. In September of 1937, Ignace Rice is murdered by the GPU. Ignace Rice was a GPU operative. And this is very significant. The GPU operative, who was a part of gaining the frame-up, the documents for the frame-up trials, and he was just about to release all of that to world public opinion. Unfortunately, I spoke about sectarianism earlier, he got in touch with a guy called Sneevliet. It's probably a bad pronunciation of his name, but he doesn't deserve to have his name pronounced very well. This was somebody who was a member of the International Communist League with the, I think, the Belgian section, but had gone to the worst ultra-leftism. And Trotsky writes to him and says, look, we must, when Ignace Rice sort of defected from the GPU, said we must make this a huge public splash, otherwise incredibly dangerous events will happen. But unfortunately, Sneevliet advised Rice against coming out publicly, and therefore made the job of the GPU in assassinating him so much easier. So Trotsky wrote in September 30th, 1937, this letter to Sneevliet. So, yesterday I sent Comrade Sneevliet the following cable: Rice assassination by GPU facilitated by false policy concealment. Only immediate open campaign in world press can save his wife. Further procrastination, fatal. United action necessary. Leo. This got a very vague response from Sneevliet. And Trotsky said, yeah, the declaration had a totally vague content, was signed by an absolutely unknown name, and the annotation of Sneevliet was also as vague as possible. In other words, the declaration was sufficient to provoke energetic actions on the part of the GPU, but absolutely insufficient to interest public opinion. The matter could not be launched in a more inefficient and dangerous manner. When Besedovsky or Agabekov broke their relations with the bureaucracy, they did it in a public, open, and aggressive manner, and only by this procedure did they save their lives. Rice had in his hands materials concerning the Moscow trials. The first courageous declaration of his, quote, I was Trotsky said that, yeah, Rice should have said this. I was until today a responsible agent of the GPU. I know the secrets of the Moscow trials. I will communicate them to world public opinion, etc. Would make his name internationally known and his assassination by the GPU politically impossible. I could absolutely not understand why such a matter of tremendous importance remains a little private affair between Rice and Sneevliet instead of becoming immediately an affair of the Fourth International. And he goes on. So, and this tells us a lot about our technique of opposing repression. That fundamentally it is a political struggle. That the only way to fight back against state or fascist or Stalinist or any forms of repression is to come out publicly and politically, and mobilize mass public opinion. And unfortunately, the sectarians were playing silly little games, and this led to the death of Rice, which was an absolute scandal, because the man was very, very capable. In December of 1937, the Dewey Commission declares Trotsky not guilty. And Trotsky calls for an offensive against Stalinism in the world working class movement, a tendency of blood and terror, and to ostracize the Stalinists within the world working class movement. Going back to the legacy of sectarianism in, unfortunately, the fledgling Fourth International and within the general movement, here's a fantastic short document, short writing by Trotsky, which I think is actually online. It's called Undemocratic Centralism, A Few Words About the Party Regime, December 8th, 1937. To the editors of Socialist Appeal, during the past months, I have received letters in regard to the inner regime of a revolutionary party from several apparently young comrades unknown to me. Some of these letters complain about the, quote, lack of democracy in your organization, about the domineering of the leaders and the like. This was to the American party. Individual comrades asked me to give a clear and exact formula on democratic centralism, which would preclude false interpretations. Trotsky goes on. I do not think that I can give such a formula on democratic centralism that once and for all would eliminate misunderstandings and false interpretations. A party is an active organism. It develops in the struggle with outside obstacles and inner contradictions. The malignant decomposition of the Second and Third Internationals under the severe conditions of the imperialist epoch creates for the Fourth International difficulties unprecedented in history. One cannot overcome them with some sort of magic formula. The regime of a party does not fall ready-made from the sky, but is formed gradually in the struggle. A political line predominates over the regime. First of all, it is necessary to define strategic problems and tactical methods correctly in order to solve them. The organizational forms should correspond to the strategy and the tactic. Only correct policy can guarantee a healthy party regime. This, it is understood, does not mean that the development of the party does not raise organizational problems as such, but it means that the formula for democratic centralism must inevitably find a different expression in the parties of different countries and different stages of the development of one and the same party. I apologize for this. Is actually quite, I'm going to continue and quote this, but it's actually, it's quite powerful and really expresses the content. Democracy and centralism do not at all find themselves in an invariable ratio to one another. Everything depends on the concrete circumstances, on the political situation in the country, on the strength of the party and its experience, on the general level of its members, on the authority the leadership has succeeded in winning. Before a conference, when the problem is one of formulating a political line for the next period, democracy triumphs over centralism. When the problem is political action, centralism subordinates democracy to itself. Democracy again asserts its rights when the party feels the need to examine critically its own actions. The equilibrium between democracy and centralism establishes itself in the actual struggle. At moments it is violated and then again re-established. The maturity of each member of the party expresses itself particularly in the fact that he does not demand from the party regime more than it can give. The person who defines his attitude to the party by the individual fillips that he gets on the nose is a poor revolutionist. It is necessary, of course, to fight against every individual mistake of the leadership, every injustice and the like, but it is necessary to assess these injustices and mistakes not by themselves, but in connection with the development, general development of the party, both on a national and international scale. A correct judgment and a feeling of proportion in politics is an extremely important thing. The person who has propensities for making a mountain out of a molehill can do much harm to himself and to the party. The misfortune of such people as Ola, Field, Weisbord and others consists in their lack of a feeling for proportion. So I think that is actually something that we have to instill in the every layer of the revolutionary movement, an understanding of a genuine Marxist militant democratic centralism, that it is a democracy for action, not just a democracy for talking. And this is an ongoing conquest to educate the cadres in the genuine traditions of Bolshevism, the genuine traditions of the international Trotskyist movement. And so I again recommend these books to the comrades. So I'm coming to the end of this lead off. I've been speaking for an hour now. But the end of where I'd like to end is both very sad and has a lot of lessons for us. In February 16th, 1938, so what was that, 71 years ago, Trotsky's son, Leon Sedov, was murdered by the Stalinists. He was only 32 years old. His two daughters had committed suicide under pressure of the Stalinists. His youngest son, who was not interested in politics, was arrested, who was an engineer, was arrested by the Stalinists, sent to the Gulag in 1937 and disappeared, accused for poisoning workers with gas, purely out of spite by Stalin. And then Leon Sedov, who was the main organizer of the International Communist League, which had become the movement for the Fourth International, was murdered. Actually, Ted Grant said that he met with him, as Ted was coming through France. He met with Sedov about a week before he died, and Sedov said he was going to hospital, and Ted said, warned him not to go. Unfortunately, Sedov was murdered. And there's two, and this says a lot to us. And I know that I always take sort of quite a personal connection with this, that Trotsky's obituary to his son is incredibly touching. And I also, it's not available online. It's a scandal. But he details his son's life, even getting into a fight with Kerensky's kids in the schoolyard in 1917. In the period of their, you know, working together in the international left opposition, he said that, things were not necessarily easy between himself and his son, that his son had a very close relation to his mother, but with his father. You know, so intimate a collaboration did not, however, mean that no disputes or occasionally even sharp clashes arose between us, neither at that time nor later in emigration. And this must be said candidly, were my relations with Leon by any means of an even and placid character. To his categorical judgments, which were often disrespectful of some of the old men of the opposition, I not only counterposed equally categoric corrections and reservations, but I also displayed towards him the pedantic and exacting attitude which I had acquired in practical questions. Because of these traits, which are perhaps useful and even indispensable for work on a large scale, but quite insufferable in personal relationships, people closest to me often had a very hard time. And inasmuch as the closest to me of all the youth was my son, he usually had the hardest time of all. To a superficial eye, it might even have seemed that our relationship was permeated with severity and aloofness. But beneath the surface, there glowed a deep mutual attachment based on something immeasurably greater than bonds of blood, a solidarity of views and appraisals, of sympathies and antipathies, of joys and sorrows experienced together, of great hopes we had in common. And just to end his obituary for his son. Before they killed him, the Stalinists did everything in their power to slander and blacken our son in the eyes of contemporaries and of prosperity. Stalin and his henchmen tried to depict Leon as an agent of fascism, a secret partisan of capitalist restoration in the USSR, the organizer of railway wrecks and murder of workers. The efforts of the scoundrels are in vain. Tons of Thermidorian filth rebound from his young figure, leaving not a stain on them. Leon was a thoroughly clean, honest, pure human being. He could, before any working class gathering, tell the story of his life, alas, so brief, day by day, as I have briefly told it here. He had nothing to be ashamed of or to hide. Moral nobility was the basic warp of his character. He unwaveringly served the cause of the oppressed because he remained true to himself. From the hands of nature and history, he emerged as a man of heroic mould. The great awe-inspiring events which hover over us will need such people. Had Leon lived to participate in these events, he would have shown his true stature. But he did not live. Our Leon, boy, son, heroic fighter, is no more. There is more but in this, but I'm not going to go on because this touches me. But what did Trotsky do? What did the International Left Opposition do? A movement that was less convinced of the future, that was less able to fight, would have taken these personal attacks and it would have destroyed them. They destroyed the whole of Trotsky's family before in 1940 murdering Trotsky himself. What was his response, comrades? What was his response? Was it to lay down? No. Trotsky fought even harder for the memory of Sedov, to fight back against a vicious Stalinism, a bloody regime. And Trotsky increased his impatience for the founding of the Fourth International, that it is vital, the formation of the Fourth International. He wrote the transitional program to reorientate the movement, the revolutionary movement, for the struggles that impended. Unfortunately, you know, we understand now, with the view of history, that the Fourth International was not to come to victory at the end of the Second World War. The Trotskyist movement was an analysing the inevitability of World War. But what Trotsky did was lay down the ideas and the methods which us revolutionaries can pick up. We can pick up that red thread of the transitional programme. In September 2nd of 1938, the Fourth International was founded. And the ideas present at that Congress are ideas we live on today. Capitalism is in crisis, in comrades. And Trotsky, through his writings of this period and before, lay forward for us the method, the tactics, how we can orientate our forces, how we can take a small group with correct ideas into a mass force, comrades. The international Marxist tendency can be proud of itself, of going through decades upon decades of reaction when the genuine ideas of Marxism have been slandered and forgotten, and we can say that we alone on the planet hold true to Trotsky's analysis, the method that is the only way of achieving victory. So I encourage the comrades, learn from these ideas. Let's build a CADA International, an international that can put to bed the ideas of Stalinism, the ideas of reformism, the imperialism that oppresses workers on an international scale. These are the ideas that can move material forces. And it's our job to go forward and do it. Thank you, comrades.